COVID is on the rise once again across Florida as officials call for a statewide mask mandate. Another rash of shootings puts Jacksonville at a terrible record for homicides, even before the year is out. And controversy continues over Lot J, some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Already getting your calls? Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, how you can do a 6 feet of separation celebration this Thanksgiving. Some ideas for your table from Edible Magazine. That's later on, but first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times-Union. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record back with us. Hey, Mike.
Good morning, Melissa.
Writer, journalist Nikisha Williams. Hey, Nikisha.
Hey, Melissa. Hey, everybody.
And rounding out our panel, David Jones of First Coast News. Hey, David.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. Lots to talk about this week. We'll go to everyone's calls in a moment. Already getting your calls. It's 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic. The Florida Department of Health announced 9,085 new cases Thursday of coronavirus. That's the second highest single day increase this month. They also reported 79 new deaths across the state. The death toll from COVID in Florida stands at 17,810. We just need to stress that cases are skyrocketing around the state, and we are heading into a dangerous period with this virus. Everyone must continue to mask and socially distance as much as they can. Now, because of the situation, a group of mayors around Florida called on Governor Ron DeSantis to issue a statewide mask mandate. They did this during a conference call on Wednesday. These are mostly South Florida mayors, but also one from St. Petersburg. And they urged DeSantis to take a range of more aggressive actions to confront the outbreak, including expanding state testing and contact tracing. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry was not on the call. He has extended the mask mandate for Duval County, we need to point out. And at the same time, Duval Schools this week said they will extend virtual learning as an option for parents through the rest of the school year because the virus remains a concern. More news. Governor DeSantis said Thursday Florida is planning a distribution plan for a COVID vaccine. Five hospitals around the state will apparently be storing these vaccines, one from Pfizer, one from Moderna. That includes UF Health in Jacksonville. So we're going to begin with a look at all of the news around coronavirus. Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. Mayors around the state are raising the alarm about the governor's response to coronavirus, even as he announces we're going to be getting a vaccine soon. Mayor Curry in Jacksonville, to his credit, keeps extending the mask mandate. At the same time, there are calls for a statewide mask mandate. The governor says no to that.
Well, I have been to a number of public events in the past week or two, and I'm appalled at the number of people who are not wearing masks, as I even wear a KN95 and never take it off. So that is a concern. And I was talking with State Attorney Melissa Nelson this week, and she told me earlier this week that they were going to have an interesting trial coming up. Well, guess what? Because of some COVID-19 exposure, the two trials scheduled in Duval County have been put on hold right now. So there we go. It's even striking into the court system, despite all of the efforts in keeping that building closed.
Wow. Nikisha Williams, what do you make of this announcement from the governor that we're weeks away from getting a vaccine and UF Health in Jacksonville would be one of the five facilities around Florida that would store the vaccine and theoretically take part in distributing it?
I think that's great news for Jacksonville and for UF Health. But I don't think the fact that Jacksonville will be a place that is going to store the vaccine abdicates him of the responsibility to the people of Florida and the people of Jacksonville specifically, since this is where we are, to ensure that everyone remains safe until they can have access to the vaccine. Just because the vaccine is coming here for storage does not mean that we're all going to get it at the same time, and does not mean that suddenly you can go around and be without a mask and be negligent and not social distance because you figure that a savior is on the way. That's irresponsible.
Yeah. Mike Mendenhall, you know, there really is a coronavirus fatigue. I think it's fair to say people are so tired of dealing with this, but now is not the time to let our guard down. There was concern this week about a rave that happened in Jacksonville, where a lot of people were gathered together without any social distancing or masking. People are taking unnecessary risks right now that they really shouldn't be.
That's right. And that rave was at the River City Brewing Company, which is a restaurant in downtown South Bank. And it's, you know, which has also been in the news recently for a possible change in ownership. And, you know, this, people need to understand, even though they do have that fatigue, that, you know, wearing masks not only protects your protects people around you, but recent information given out by both the CDC and the nation's top infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci shows that that mask also protects you. So it is incredibly important to do that. And with the holiday season coming up, emotions are high. People want to go see their families for Thanksgiving, and but we need to remember that, you know, that is extensive traveling is just a way to further spread this virus. And in order for us to, you know, to all be here and all be around for subsequent following holidays, we need to make sure we're taking care of each other now.
Yeah. David Jones, First Coast News. Virtual learning has been extended for local students. There had been some concern that they might cut that off at the end of 2020. But for parents that do want their children to continue with virtual learning in Duval County, that is going to continue through the rest of the school year. We are a multi-county area, though, and as people have been pointing out here, we have a mask mandate in Duval County. We don't have it in the surrounding counties.
That's right. And I wanted to bring this up, Melissa, because I feel like the discourse around masks in Florida really changed at a certain point when the governor came down and said that these local ordinances enforcing mask usage really had no teeth, could not be enforced. That's when I feel things really started to shift. We saw St. Augustine used to have their own mask mandate, which they then got rid of because of that. So, yes, I mean, the mask mandate here in Duval County has been extended, but there's no enforcement standards for that because these municipalities were told that by the governor. So not only did the municipalities get kind of sideswiped by that, but also just the discourse among people in general has been, well, the governor has said these mask mandates aren't enforceable, so therefore they must not be necessary. So, I can only speak for myself in that I feel like that narrative really shifted at that point, and mask usage just wasn't as serious as it was before.
We're leading off our Friday roundtable talking about all the news around coronavirus. What are your Thanksgiving plans, by the way? The Centers for Disease Control is asking everyone not to travel this holiday. The number of Thanksgiving travelers is expected to be down. You should not be in a big gathering this holiday season. We'll have more about that later in the hour. But in the meantime, give us a call as we talk about spiking COVID cases, news of a vaccine coming soon, and some mayors around Florida begging the governor for more stringent measures to combat rising COVID cases. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Scott is on the north side. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Hello to everybody. First of all, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves as a country. This is a virus that is not a known virus. This is something brand new. The first thing that it teach you that you want to do every precaution for the unknown. But as this country here, we have mixed leadership, a leadership that is not empathetic to the needs of the country. And it's appalling that the news media has not held everybody accountable for this virus. And what I mean by holding everybody accountable, as I said from the very beginning, if you do not know the virus, don't have a history of it, then you do every precaution from the very beginning. And leadership,
well, you know, Scott, we've been covering it since March and trying to hold local and national officials accountable and point out that there has been no comprehensive national strategy to combat coronavirus. There has been no comprehensive testing and contact tracing program for the entire country to combat coronavirus. No calls for national mask wearing. We have been pointing that out from the outset, but I appreciate your call. That's Scott calling. Dan Scanlon, there's so much frustration about this and so much weariness, I think.
There is, but yet I still find people who seem to feel that it's not that bad. Like I said, I was at an event on Sunday, and nobody was wearing a mask other than those of us that were involved, pretty much, and no one seemed to care, and I've heard that comment before. Now, it's obviously getting out there. AAA, as I'm writing in my traffic column for tomorrow, indicates that there are millions less people expected to travel this weekend, and that's before the CDC started pleading yesterday, don't go anywhere unless you're hanging out with a close-knit family for Thanksgiving. Try to stop the spread.
Lots of tweets. Debbie writes us, a mask mandate is the bare minimum we can do. Katie on Twitter, why is the mask mandate a monthly thing? Dr. Fauci says we'll need it all through next year, even with a vaccine. Why are bars open when we have a 7% positive rate? That does not seem good. Schools should be the priority, she says. Here's one more tweet. I wear a mask. Others don't. If you know someone who has died of COVID, you wear a mask. If you believe in the golden rule, you wear a mask. If you are only out for yourself, you don't wear a mask. Selfish people abound, but what can we do, they say. It's 549-2937. Cynthia is along Lakeshore Boulevard. Hi, Cynthia. Go ahead, Cynthia. You're on the radio. Cynthia, go ahead and turn your radio down and talk to us. Okay, Cynthia, we're going to put you back on hold. Keep listening. We'll try to get you back on in a moment. Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark. Oh, actually, we lost that call. Let me see if we can get Cynthia back. Hi, Cynthia. Are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I have to get to my radio. I'm away from it in another room.
Go ahead, Cynthia. You're on the radio.
I want to implore people to think of the people who are taking care of us. The hospital personnel, the doctors are pleading, saying they're exhausted from this. The hospital personnel are saying that they are exhausted from this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we were just to think of them and their well-being, and they're doing their best to take care of our, you know, of people, to do all of those things that we're asked to do would make a huge difference to them. Just their more, you know, just their moral support.
Yeah.
That's my hope.
Yeah. Thank you, Cynthia. Nikisha Williams, we really do need to once again express our thanks to all of the medical personnel across this region and everybody who's on the front lines of dealing with this pandemic. Police, firefighters, teachers, food delivery workers. There's so many people that are risking their health, their lives to try to get us through this. And at the very top of the list, as she points out, are medical personnel. When you talk to medical personnel who've been treating these patients, you understand how serious this disease can be.
Absolutely. I wrote a piece where I spoke with a surgeon who's been on the front lines of seeing COVID cases come in and come into the ER and seeing that trauma and that death. And for those people that say it's a hoax, all you have to do is talk to anyone in the medical profession to see that they are dealing with death every day. 250,000 dead Americans from this virus is not a hoax. And the fact that we as citizens won't do the basic things to keep ourselves safe, to try to get this under control until the vaccine is able to be massively distributed, is absolutely ridiculous. And we are putting our healthcare workers, our teachers, our grocery store workers, our delivery cab and stuff drivers, we're putting all of them at risk because we want to be comfortable. There's no, I mean, yes, we might have virus fatigue, but guess who doesn't? The 250,000 people who have died, they can't have virus fatigue, so we shouldn't either.
Mike Mendenhall, I think the worry a lot of healthcare professionals have is if we aren't seeing this, let's be clear, we are not seeing this in North Florida. Hospitals are not overwhelmed currently. They are able to handle this. But I think the concern is that if we do see a continued upward trend, hospitals will be overwhelmed. And say you have to go to the hospital for another problem, you might not get the treatment you need because they're overwhelmed dealing with this.
Yeah, and I mean, and you're starting to see nationwide, particularly Republican governors in states who have resisted putting in place mask mandates and additional closures to change course, and specifically for that reason, to make sure that hospitals aren't overrun. I know in my home state of Iowa, the Republican governor, Kim Reynolds, finally put in a mask mandate after months of resistance. When the data became clear that with a 50% positivity rate statewide, that eventually hospitals in that state would be overrun, and they even had to put in a restriction on elective surgeries. They reduced elective surgeries by 50%. So you're starting to see those kind of things in, especially in the Midwestern states, the Great Plains states. Scientists have said, you know, as the winter goes on and we see continued spread of the virus, I mean, that could begin to impact again other states in the nation.
Johnson on the West Side. Hi, Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, what I was calling for is because I so believe in masks. I have underlying medical conditions, and I also have a child, an adult child, who has underlying medical conditions. And when I go shopping, I literally pick where I shop at based on how the associates deal with non-mask wearers. So I live in Westside. I have a choice between Walmart and Target. I normally shop at Target because I've seen people walk in there with no mask, and an associate comes up to them and offers them a mask. Where mm-hmm. Walmart, they see them and they keep walking. So to me, I make my decisions based on how the businesses deal with non-mask wearers versus mask wearers.
Sure.
And that was all.
Yeah. Johnson, thanks. David Jones, First Coast News. I hear this all the time. People are making their purchasing decisions around this. And I increasingly hear, too, from folks in Duval County who say, particularly those who live near the county line, between Duval and St. John's, who say, you know, I'm just going to make a choice to go to the grocery store on the Duval side of the line because I just feel safer that way. I feel like people are taking the masking more seriously, depending on where they are.
Yeah, it's an important decision to have to make, and we talk about this so much. But if you're at home and you've got an elderly parent, you've got someone who's immune compromised who lives with you, those are choices that you have to make, and it doesn't stay to party lines. I mean, it shouldn't be a partisan issue. Masks should not be, and unfortunately, they did become a partisan issue very early on in this pandemic. So I think it's a place of privilege to be able to say, I'm going to go out and not wear a mask. It's a place of privilege to be able to say, I don't think this virus is that serious. It's not really going to affect me. I haven't been affected by it myself. When we are, you know, hear from callers here who say this is a cognizant decision that I have to make every single day. So it shouldn't be a political issue. It became one. And I think as a country, we need to kind of come together and realize that this is necessary. It's necessary to stop the spread.
Absolutely right. Let me take one more call on this, then we'll move on to some other news from the week. Linda in Mandarin. Linda, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I was thinking about what was happening overall in America, not only with this virus, but with our politics. We are certainly not the greatest generation, but they had a common narrative that they had to sacrifice. You know, African Americans went to fight in a war when they couldn't eat at a lunch counter, but they understood it was a shared sacrifice. We had to defend America. And now people have the attitude that, you know, hey, it doesn't impact me, so I don't care if it impacts you. I'm not going to do the right thing. And I, too, try to make decisions. I dart in, and when I see the people without masks, I just try to get my few things. If there's too many people, I'll just abandon my cart and leave, because some of us are more likely, and I'm one of those people. I've been in sheltering in place since March. I've only been to one event in the garden at Comer. I haven't been to any family or friend functions. I am not going home for Thanksgiving. But guess what? If I live this year, I'll hopefully be with my family next year. it's so selfish to only think about today.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Linda. Yeah, we are a long way from everyone doing a victory garden and all being on the same page, unfortunately. You are absolutely right about that. So I guess the final thing to say about this before we move on is, people, take this seriously. Wear your masks. Keep distancing. Don't have a big Thanksgiving gathering. Just please stay the course. It is our Friday roundtable. We're talking about the biggest stories of the week with Dan Scanlon, Mike Mendenhall, Nakeisha Williams, David Jones, and yours truly. It's 549-2937 as we move on and talk about another sobering story. With several weeks to go in the year, Jacksonville has already tied its 2019 total for homicides. A double shooting in the Lackawanna neighborhood led to the death of a 29-year-old woman this week and the injury of another bystander. This brings us, Dan Scanlon, to the 160th homicide in the city for the year. It's just unbelievable that even in the middle of this pandemic, when people are theoretically not out and about as much, the gun violence we're witnessing happen in this city continues unchecked.
Actually, we had a homicide last night in the Moncrief area. So according to Jacksonville's unofficial, or the Times Union's unofficial tally, the homicide rate now stands at 162. That's two over all of last year's total. And that does not include the police-involved shooting Tuesday night, which the sheriff's office released the video last night with a statement indicating that the medical examiner said that the young victim in that had a self-inflicted wound. So it has been a hell of a week. I spoke with multiple people from the state attorney on down on this, and nobody knows the cause. It could be COVID-19, people being tired of being locked down. It could be the lack of jobs, and there's some illegal money raising going on out there. It could be domestic. There's been a number of domestics, but among those domestics, there's also been a fairly large number of children killed, including some unborn children, when their parents, their mother was shot. So it's just, this week has been tragic. I literally want to go get a cheeseburger right now. It has been so bad, and the heck with my healthy diet.
Nakeisha Williams, there's nothing more we can say about this that we haven't already said so many times, other than to point out that this is an absolute tragedy for this city.
It's an absolute tragedy for the city, for the families, for these neighborhoods that continue to be affected by this, because it's some of the same ones over and over and over again. But it again goes to, and I think I said this last year when things were a little more normal, Jacksonville has always had a crime problem, and the root issues of that problem have never been treated. We always try to treat the crime by bulking up on law enforcement and programs that run through the justice system, but we're not really trying to treat the problem. So as Dan just mentioned, it could be a whole host of issues, from lack of jobs or finances to coronavirus to illegal activity to domestic violence. All of those issues come into play, and they all have to be treated at once and in these communities to give people a reason to not, you know, just say F it. And that's what we're seeing in a response to a lot of these underlying conditions that have not really been addressed.
Mike Mendenhall, the city has put some taxpayer money behind a program called Cure Violence that's aimed at bringing these numbers down. It's had mixed success so far. What are your thoughts about the city response?
Well, I mean, you know, Mayor Curry has said a few times that, you know, the Cure Violence program needs to take time to take root in these communities. You know, the objective of these is to send people into, you know, communities that are, known to have increased rates of violence, and try to mitigate it and stop it before it happens. Try to get to, you know, to mitigate gang activity, those kind of things. But whether it takes, you know, depending on how long it takes, I mean, it is worth noting that currently, you know, the city council, you know, it's rare for the city council to have a long, extended discussion or debate on the statistics. Right now, you know, they're debating a you know, several hundred million dollar deal with Shad Khan with Lot J.
And yeah.
So it always seems to kind of take a back seat to some of these other issues.
And we'll talk about Lot J in a moment. First, though, getting lots of calls about the city's endlessly horrible gun violence and homicide problem. Bob is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning. I work with a nonprofit, Florida Youth Maritime Training. We cooperate with a group called Mad Dads in providing free vocational training to disadvantaged youth at risk to become employed as merchant seamen. Our graduates are, generally speaking, starting off working at about $37,000 a year. We are getting no cooperation from the city of Jacksonville or the sheriff's office in helping to administer this program, and I keep wondering why. Thank you.
David Jones, First Coast News. Your thoughts on Bob's remark. Oh, we might have lost David Jones. We'll try to get him back. Meanwhile, let's get to a few more calls. It's 549-2937. AJ on the line in Arlington. Hi, AJ. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and happy Thanksgiving to everybody. My comment is, while we're talking about jobs and what we need to do to reduce the crime, especially the murder rate, I know we have more unsolved murders than solved. The community really have to take the lead role in this. We use a word in Jacksonville called stakeholders a lot, and the community is the stakeholder in solving the problems, because while we add jobs and stuff, if the murderers are still out there, they still killing and recruiting these young men and women. So we need to constantly encourage the community, which is what Mad Dads does, to come up, speak up, and stand up for our community and get these murderers and killers off our streets. Thank y'all, and y'all have a good holiday.
Thanks, AJ. David Jones, do we have you back with us? Are you linked back up? Okay. The perils of social distancing as we try to connect everyone virtually. Dan Scanlon, Nikisha Williams, let's go back to you. That was AJ with Mad Dads. That's an organization that's been working in this community for many years to try to get us safer streets, less gun violence. And there are, you know, there are a number of organizations, faith-based groups, other groups, all kinds of people trying to work on this problem. It's not as though there has been no effort made to try to make Jacksonville a safer city. Okay, we're having issues with more than one of our guests. Do we have Nikisha?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think that it's for a lack of effort. I think that it's a lack of consistency. And over my time in Jacksonville, you see different administrations come in and they all have an idea or a plan to do something different. But at the end of the day, no matter what that plan is, there needs to be some consistency in engaging the community and engaging the stakeholders and engaging the people. So if cure violence is a thing now, it needs to be a thing 10 years from now so that it can continue to work. It can't just be NIBIN and ShotSpotter and all of the different technologies that we have in, but there does need to be actual work in these communities. But then there also needs to be investment. There needs to be investment, grocery stores, small businesses, retail stores, all the things that make a community work, because then you are putting people that live there to work in their own community and allowing them to have something to keep up. But when you drive through these areas on the north side and the west side and some of these problem spots where things are bad, there isn't really anything there. And so that has to be a component too. And I don't think that part of it is ever really addressed. There need to be community centers for children so that they don't have to be on the streets. There need to be, again, grocery stores and different businesses. There has to be investment in the community beyond the police and the few churches and organizations that are working to just to keep the crime at bay.
Michael is on the northeast side. Michael in Northeast Jacks. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air.
Melissa, one of the things that is causing tremendous upsetness in cities is gangs, powerful gangs located in the town. That's where they get the local people, but also coming from other countries, drugs. And one of the things that the government could do, especially a community like Jacksonville, they could declare, if you are a member of one of these organized gangs whose drugs and violence are just systemic, is declare them terrorists and treat them under the law, a new law, as terrorists so that they could be prosecuted and done quickly. The killings that come, a lot of this is, as I say, drug-related, and that's the comment. But the law has to change so that they will become terrorists, and they would lose by being in the gang, their citizens' rights.
All right, Michael, thanks. And, you know, a minute ago, one of you mentioned how much money this city is contemplating spending on a downtown development and how much they're not spending by comparison on the bloody toll of the gun violence in this city. And it really does bring into sharp relief the priorities our city leaders have. So with that pivot, we're going to talk about the other big story from the week right now. It was a wild meeting of the city council this week when council president Tommy Hazzouri pointed the finger at the mayor for all of the setbacks and confusion that have surrounded Jaguars owner Shad Khan's proposed Lot J project. This is the development Mr. Khan wants to build next to the football stadium. It will cost over $400 million, and about half of that would come from you and me, the taxpayers. Here is Hazzouri at a tense meeting last night. Take a listen.
I'm not going to deal with stuff like this. This is too important of an issue, too complex of an issue for us to just sit here and hurry up and wait.
Curry's chief administrative officer, Brian Hughes, took issue with those comments, and it led to this exchange.
You just disparaged my team, my staff, and my mayor, so I just take a minute to tell you your characterizations are wrong, sir.
I'm not giving you a characterization.
They're wrong. Yes,
I'm
sir.
Telling you how it's
what, you
been.
Said things that are not correct.
I'm telling you how it's been.
We That's don't not wanna, correct.
We never heard anything.
You
from
said
him.
Things that are not correct, sir.
Okay, so after all of that, the city council didn't take any real action on the Lot J proposal last night. Several members said the whole meeting was a waste of their time. Mayor Curry is asking the city to borrow more than $200 million to invest in this development and bypass the city's Downtown Investment Authority, which is theoretically supposed to oversee these kinds of projects. Last night, a lot of the hue and cry dealt with whether or not the DIA should review the deal and how they should do it. David Jones, First Coast News, you were at the meeting. What all went on here?
Melissa, this could be the entire show. Could just be unpacking this meeting. It was insane. I mean, your listeners may not want to, you know, get into all the technicalities, but that's really what this was. The majority of the meeting was spent discussing technicalities around how the council could send this legislation to the Downtown Investment Authority for review. It seemed like there was a consensus that needed to happen. We knew going into that Councilman Matt Carlucci, finance chair, was going to propose a substitute bill that was going to be co-introduced by Council President Hazzouri to do that, to send it to the DIA for review. In the meeting, Councilwoman Leanna Cumber, before that substitute was introduced her own amendment to do what sounded like the same thing, but once they started getting into the weeds of it, were two different proposals of how to do so and how it would affect the overall process. And so this was a back and forth. There was some contention between Councilman Aaron Bowman, who lashed out against Council President Hazzouri on whether Carlucci could be brought in to compare his substitute while the amendment was on the floor. You know, at one point, Bowman saying, "You're not fit for this job." I mean, it was really just heated. I'd not seen anything like that before. And in the end, that whole debate was rendered moot because Councilman Becton, Danny Becton, stood up and said, "I've just been informed by the administration that this deal is going to DIA for review." So they spent more than an hour discussing how to do that. And then in the end, it's sent anyways. So there was just at the end, there was this idea that no one really won here. The questions and answers were not discussed. And it seemed like a giant waste of time.
Wow. Mike Mendenhall, let's be clear. We were just talking about the gun violence and homicide problem in this city. Jacksonville has spent a little money on that lately, but not a lot, comparatively speaking, when you consider that what the big argument among city officials is right now is how we're going to spend more than $200 million for this development that looks great and could bring a return on investment. But still, this is money that's being spent in the height of a recession and a deadly pandemic, and it's seemingly without much oversight or review.
Yeah, and there's still a question as to how much or how great the return on investment will be for the city. There's competing reviews out there, one by the administration, which suggests that the deal would, for every dollar invested, it'd bring back $1.63 to the city, I believe is the number. And then the council auditor, who is an independent actor in this situation, her review suggests that it would only bring back about 44 cents for every dollar the city invested, which that disparity is really what's kind of brought on this call for more transparency, more evaluation. And David hit the nail on the head. I couldn't have characterized that meeting any better. As far as the difference between what Councilwoman Cumber and what Councilmember Carlucci are proposing is the Carlucci's bill would have actually sent this whole Lodge A process back to the negotiating table. The DIA would have had to do an appraisal on the Lodge A lot property, a 30-day notice of disposition. They would have had to renegotiate the term sheet that the Curry administration has spent a couple of years working on. But some council members, Hazuri and Carlucci in particular, feel like that kind of vetting needs to happen. Whereas Councilwoman Cumber's bill will actually send it to the DIA just as it, in its current state, and they would evaluate its merits now, and it would take about 2 weeks. So, and the Jaguars president Mark Lamping last night, he said that they are not interested in going back to the negotiating table, going back to square one. So this fight is not over.
Mm. Nikisha Williams, among other things ShotKam wants to build in the sports complex, he's also looking to bring a Four Seasons to this development. It would go on the site of the former Metropolitan Park, a very high-end hotel experience that he's saying would be something of an anchor for all the other stuff they want to build. The MOSH, the Museum of Science and History, wants to relocate across the river and be right next to where the Four Seasons would go on the site of the old shipyards lot. You know, if all of this comes to pass, it could be really cool. It could be really exciting. I think the big debate now, though, is that there needs to be a bit more oversight, a more due diligence exercise because of the eye-popping amounts of money that the city is looking to spend and just how aspirational all of this seems to be, particularly the Four Seasons, whether it could be viable in this location over time.
I think that the pitch for Lot J, the Four Seasons, and then the new MOSH on the North Bank is all pretty feasible. But it's been a thing since ShotKam bought the Jaguars, when, what was that, 2011, that, oh, he's a billionaire, let him build the city the way we want it to be. And if he builds it, then everything else will come. And in a way, that's true with the Four Seasons anchoring, you having a new museum. I think that would lead to other ideas that have been thrown around for a while, including a new convention center and more hotels downtown, and maybe even that lofty idea of having an aquarium. But before we take out investments and loans for $200 million or $450 million. I mean, we need to figure out where this money is coming from and how it's getting paid back. And right now, those details aren't there.
Rick on the north side. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, Miss Melissa. I was just calling just to ask a quick question, but two quick questions. One, I know they said that return on investment, I think it's 44 cents. And my question is, how much is it making now when it's just sitting in the bank or in an escrow account? That's one question. And the second question is, when was the last time we had something in Jacksonville, you know, something built, a place that we can go in, and like you just said, Ms. Melissa, something eye-popping? That'll be my question.
Sure, yeah. Dan Scanlon, a council auditor report said that the return on investment for this deal is 44 cents on the dollar. That's more conservative than the estimates the developers have put forth. So that is a legitimate question. And as Rick pointed out, the idea is to create something exciting, something that will draw people into the urban core. The question is, how much should the taxpayers spend on that?
I don't know. What he says is true. The last time there was anything exciting on the river was the landing in its heyday. Now there is nothing there except an abandoned condo building and a lot of green space used for parking or walking your dog. It's interesting. I talked with City Councilman Garrett Dennis this week on the crime problem, a lot of those homicides in his neighborhood, in his district. He says the city's leadership has, quote-unquote, completely failed, and he says Lot J is, quote, probably the biggest corporate giveaway that the city has ever undergone. So if we can get it to work, if we can get an aquarium, if we can build in, bring in a Navy ship, which is still in the process, and have a whole strip from the sheriff's office on down to the stadium that is filled with fun things to do and earn money, it might work. But again, what did I hear this week? It's going to take up to 3 years to clean up the stuff that's underneath Lot J, because remember, where your studio is and where the stadium is and where Lot J is was where they built Liberty ships and shipbuilding way back in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So gosh knows what's underneath that land right now as far as hazardous waste.
Right. David Jones, apparently cleaning up all the contamination at these sites could take some time. And let's close with you, David. What will be the role going forward of the Downtown Investment Authority in all of this, based on what we heard last night?
Well, that's going to be really interesting, because we don't know the scope right now, and maybe Mike knows a little bit more than I do from sources, but from what I'm aware, we don't know the scope of the DIA's review right now. I would imagine that it's probably similar to what Cumber was proposing, which was to send the bill as filed to DIA to make a recommendation on. If that's the case, a couple things that we learned last night, one of them was that there are still changes being made to the development agreement. Not just the parking agreement, which we knew was still being molded, but the development agreement itself, they're changing the language within that. That was something that council kind of pushed out of the administration a little bit last night. So that's really interesting. What is council's posture in considering a bill that's not complete yet, technically, or that's not finalized? And the environmental remediation part, I'm really glad that Dan brought that up, because that's something else we learned last night. So we're talking, they estimate 33 months, so nearly 3 years of environmental remediation before permitting can start. That's up to 18 months to apply for and receive permits. Then construction can start, and they have up to 36 months, so up to 3 years on that. So in totality, we're looking at the possibility of more than 7 years before the ribbon is cut on Lot J, which is pretty different than that announcement, if I remember, in early October at Daly's Place, where JAG's president, Mark Lambing, I believe, kind of alluded to saying this could, if it started next year, this could take up to 3 years to finish. So we're looking at a much different timeline than was originally presented. So it's going to be a really long conversation. And I think the important thing to remember is council is at a place now where they have to consider this bill. They can't consider the Four Seasons. They can't consider the shipyards. They have to look at this as it's filed and not as part of a broad scope of you know, developments that don't necessarily hold any weight, because there's no legislation filed for them.
So good to get all of your insights this morning. Thank you all so much. Dan Scanlon, Mike Mendenhall, Ryder Nakisha Williams, David Jones, all taking part in this media roundtable. So much news we went through. So thank you guys, and have a safe and joyous Thanksgiving next week. Thanks again.
Thanks,
Amen.
Melissa.
Yeah.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. In a moment, speaking of that, how to load up your Thanksgiving table with some great recipes and be safe. It's a 6 feet of separation celebration guide, and we've got it next.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Distracted driving is deadly. Teens, yes, but adults too. And there are millions more adults than teens. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
UF Health Jacksonville, celebrating 150 years of caring for our community. Founded in 1870, UF Health Jacksonville is a major academic health center serving Northeast Florida and Southeast Georgia. Learn more at ufhealthjacks.org.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, the CIA's secret experiments with LSD in the 50s and 60s in search of a drug to control the minds of enemies. Allen Ginsberg and Ken Kesey were introduced to LSD through the program, but other unwitting subjects in prisons and detention centers were subjected to psychological torture. We talk with journalist Stephen Kinzer. Join us
this afternoon at 1 here on WJCT News 89.9.
A second vaccine shows signs of success, but it's America's small towns that have become the new face of COVID-19. Donald Trump looks to disrupt the Electoral College. His predecessor says that move shouldn't surprise anyone.
Literally anything goes in order to get power.
I'm Jen White. Lots more to talk about on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the holiday season may look a bit different this year due to the pandemic. Of course, we're all dealing with that. However, we still have reason to be thankful and celebrate, but do it safely. Edible Northeast Florida has a new issue out called Gather, and they've got plenty of genius ideas to help you safely celebrate the holiday. Editor Lauren Titus is on the line now with more of this 6 feet of separation celebration guide. Hey, Lauren, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And it's so good to talk to you. And what a great title for this, 6 feet of separation celebrations. You've got lots of tips and ideas in this new issue. What will we learn?
Well, you know, just because we're all going to be separated doesn't mean we don't want to celebrate and eat some good food. So we have all sorts of great ideas to take advantage of our mild outdoor weather this time of year, and create some great intimate gatherings that, of course, feature wonderful food, the seasonal produce that we're finding at the farmers markets, and some ways that we can safely create a celebration for those within our pod. For instance, we've got some recipes for a pandemic pod potluck. You know, there's some concern about sharing serving utensils, for instance. So we have recommendations and recipes for individual servings that everyone can just take a cup or a skewer, like the Cajun Mayport shrimp kebabs that are easy enough to grill or bake in the oven. Everyone can just take their own kebab and not worry about a shared serving utensil. And, you know, we're really fortunate, like I say, to have great weather that we can gather outdoors safely. You can go and have an oyster roast. Oysters are in season right now, so it's a lot of fun to gather safely. You know, we're cognizant of the need to stay within the pod and to be careful about who you're gathering with. But we still want to eat good food.
Oh, gosh, yes. I think we're all looking forward to that. Now, you have a gift guide in this issue, too, with some ideas for foodies, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this year, more than ever, we're always loyal to local. But this year, it's time to recognize the importance and the value of small businesses like we've never done before. And we've got over 40 different businesses and gift ideas in the gift guide. You can probably find something for everybody on your list, from new cooks. You could sign them up for cooking classes at Jack's Cooking Studio. You can get gift certificates to One Ocean Spa. You can get gift ideas from the local distillers like Manifest and Burlock and Barrel. Craft pottery, you know, just something for everybody on your list, whether they're cooks or they want to decorate their homes or they just want to have someone else do the cooking for them.
Sure. Speaking of which, we'll be coming out with our holiday gift guide next week. And on our list is going to be the print version of your edible cookbook. It's called Provisions. Tell us about Provisions.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about that. So that's a project that was actually initiated by the pandemic. When everyone was sequestered at home in March, we realized that it would be a valuable tool for cooks, for folks that weren't really accustomed to being in the kitchen that much cooking. And we compiled over 90 recipes from our 5 years of publishing, everything from salads, soups, cocktails, and desserts, all featuring our seasonal bounty that we can find at our farmers markets throughout the year. So at that time, it was a digital cookbook, and we had enough of a demand that we decided to go ahead and print a version of it just in time for the holiday gift-giving season.
So people can learn all about this in your new issue, Gather. It's a free magazine on newsstands everywhere, Lauren. People can also look at your website online if they want to do that. Any other final Thanksgiving tips for us?
Well, just remember that, you know, this too shall pass, and to celebrate the things that we do have that we can be thankful for, and to appreciate the local food that we're seeing at the farmers market, and appreciate all the farmers and the food makers in our community that enrich our lives at Thanksgiving and year round.
Thanks so much. She's Lauren Titus, editor of Edible Northeast Florida. Pick up the new holiday Thanksgiving issue with great recipes, a gift guide. There's a cookbook, ideas for a safe Thanksgiving, and the website is edibleneflorida.com. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. Meanwhile, we always appreciate your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in show covering the biggest issues across the Sunshine State. That's the Florida Roundup today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
Baptist Health wants you to have